For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today,
Roz Watkins takes us to the Derbyshire Peak District for her new novel, Cut to the Bone.
Rosanna Amoka tells us about her powerful debut, The Book of Echoes.
And Susie Steiner on Remain Silent and her experience of sight loss.
All that plus books of your life coming up in today's show.
As regular listeners know, I love a good murder story. And my favourite contemporary crime writer has to be Roz Watkins. Her D.I. Meg Dalton series is clever, original and fast-paced, with a likeable protagonist, a sly sense of fun and a spine-tingling sense of the macabre. Set amid the rugged beauty of the Peak District, the series is like a gritstone-edged Midsummer Murders. With the third book in the series, Cut to the Bone, out now, I had the perfect excuse to haul Roz in for investigation, and I began by asking her to describe Meg's latest crime scene investigation.
So at the beginning of the book, a girl goes missing. She's 18 years old, and she's one of these sort of internet celebrity characters. She's become famous kind of accidentally for videoing herself barbecuing sausages in a bikini and putting a video on YouTube, and then it all went nuts. So she's got a big following online, but she's been working rather inexplicably in an abattoir in a small village in Derbyshire. And it's from there that she goes missing. So Meg gets called out and it all gets weirder and weirder, really, the more she looks into it. They find the blood and hair of a girl in the pig trough at the abattoir. So they're very concerned about this girl. And yeah, poor old Meg. It gets very personal, as it always does with her cases. And yeah, she has a tough time of it.
Well, as listeners will gather, it's a great mix of the everyday and the macabre. And you're not just investigating a potential murder in the book.
Yeah, there's a very serious point at the heart of the book, really, which is something that has troubled me for a very, very long time, which is the way that we keep farm animals. And this book particularly focuses on pigs. The fact that a lot of the pork that people eat in this country comes from pigs who've spent a lot of their time in crates where they can't even turn around is something that bothers me a lot. And although obviously it's a crime novel, it's not all about that by any means, but that does come into it.
You have a scientific engineering and law background. And I know when we spoke in the past, you really like to dig behind the headlines and find out the mechanics of things.
I do, yeah. And some of the research for this book was not pleasant. I was sort of digging into factory farming and also the abattoir. I mean, I decided in the end, I just didn't think it was palatable enough to go in a mainstream book, the things that go on in abattoirs. So I deliberately made the abattoir in this book a good abattoir where they try and do things as well as they possibly can within the context of killing animals. But some of the research I did was really quite unpleasant and stayed with me. But I just didn't want readers to come upon that when they thought they were reading a crime novel.
The books are all set in Derbyshire, in the Peak District, and your sense of place and the description of the very rugged beauty of that area are incredibly strong. And it's a place I know very well from my climbing.
Yeah.
And the plots are driven by the area they're written in.
Yeah. Set near Lady Bower Reservoir has got some amazing sort of edges. I'm very impressed with the people that climb there because it's just spectacular. But yeah, I love that area. And I thought the idea of these drowned villages, when they built Lady Bower Reservoir about 70 years ago, they drowned two villages. And I thought that was quite an interesting, quite creepy idea, really, that these villages have been submerged, but they come back in the hot summer as they did a couple of years ago.
Yes, which all adds to that sense of menace that has the characters and readers alike constantly wondering whether something supernatural might be going on.
Yeah, I like doing this to poor old Meg. So in this case, when the girl goes missing, it turns out that she has apparently seen a young girl that they call the Pale Child. And there's a rumour in this village that if you see the Pale Child, if you let her see your face, it means that you're going to die. And as Meg looks into it a bit more over the years, it seems that has actually happened. People have seen this girl and then they've died. So the fact that our missing teenager apparently saw her just adds to the worry for the teenager and also to Meg's confusion, because obviously it makes no sense. She doesn't know who this Pale Child is. The rumour is that she's the ghost of a child that died, who used to live in the old manor house that was drowned under the reservoir. But obviously a ghost doesn't make a huge amount of sense to Meg. So it just complicates the investigation and everyone thinks it can't be relevant, but Meg's not so sure.
It really does conjure that folklore tradition that runs behind the scenes in so many remote rural communities.
Yeah, we do have a lot of those myths and strange tales around here, and I tend to like making my own up for the purposes of the story, but I do sometimes use parts of existing ones. Like from that area, there's one about a vicar that does a sermon for dead people once a year. That gets a mention in the book. And then in previous books, I've mentioned the evil mermaids that we have in Derbyshire, despite being about 70 miles from the sea. I've got a friend who's an oral storyteller, and she's always well up on all these sorts of things. And some of them are really unpleasant, actually. So good material.
Do you think that that's got something to do with all the caves and tunnels and, as you say, drowned villages and sheer drops that you have in Derbyshire?
Maybe. I suppose a lot of areas have got their own kind of creepiness. Like, I think some of the areas that have got really flat fens and marshes are also really creepy. But we do seem to have more than average in Derbyshire. Definitely the caves. I do like a good cave. And obviously I put Meg through a rather nasty cave experience in the first book. It's one of my nightmares, the idea of having to sort of swim out of a cave. Oh, the whole, you know, I'm not even particularly claustrophobic, but the whole trapped underground thing is really nasty. So yeah, we've got lots of worries and woods and plenty of material to be going at for killing people, I think.
Well, I'm looking forward to you getting her into a climbing harness at some point in the future.
That's a good idea, actually. I'll add that to my list of ways to torture Meg. So she did have a problem with heights in the first book, although she's getting over it now. But I think that could bring it back pretty fast.
Which crime novels inspired you to take up the pen?
I was a big Enid Blyton fan. So I read and reread all the Famous Five and Secret Seven and those books. And then as I got a little bit older, I got very into Dick Francis, which he doesn't get cited very often, but I was into horses when I was a teenager. So knowing what I know now about the racing industry, I just wouldn't want anything to do with it. But I was young and naive. And so I loved his books. And then weirdly, as I got older, I didn't read as much crime. And then I just got back into it recently. But they were the ones from childhood that got me started.
And you make quite a few tongue-in-cheek references to Sunday night dramas and perfect villages where imperfect things happen behind closed doors. Are you a fan of Midsummer Murders?
I am, yes, definitely. Yes, I love it. It's funny, isn't it? I was saying the other day, it's like there's nothing more reassuring and calming on a Sunday night to sit down and watch 18 people being horribly slaughtered and stuffed into vats of boiling oil and dismembered horribly. And it's like, why does this make me feel so much better? But yeah, me and my partner, we do love a bit Midsummer. We can even re-watch them and we don't remember who did it, even though we've only watched them a couple of years ago. So yeah, there's a bit I think I put in the book when somebody says to Meg, I need to talk to you, shall I come into the station tomorrow? And she says, no, because you'll obviously die if you say that, because that always happens in Midsummer, doesn't it? So do not ever ring the police and say, I need to tell you something, I'll tell you tomorrow. You're writing your own death warrant.
They are very fun. for your books.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you find writing them fun, or is it actually very hard work to sit down and work out what torture you're going to put poor Meg through next?
It is hard work. I mean, sadly, I probably enjoyed the first one the most, which obviously was the one I wrote when I didn't have a deadline and it was a hobby. And now it's all a bit more serious. But it is still fun. It's fun and it's hard work. I mean, it's sort of easy to think of gruesome ways to kill people or scenic spots to find a body, but it's working out all the motivations for the characters and sort of making sure that it all hangs together and keeping the threads of Meg's personal life going and making sure it's personal enough for her without being ridiculous, and that hard balance between drama and realism. My agent always says drama trumps realism, so we go on the side of drama, but I don't want them to be ridiculous. You know, I want the motivations to work out and the psychology to make sense. So yes, it is hard work, but it's fun as well.
You mentioned Meg's relationships and her relationship with her mum and, in this book, her father, and also her best friend, Hannah, are central to the plot. And they're also the area in which she tends to be able to work through the case just by stepping away and seeing parallels in her personal life. You're clearly very interested in what motivates people.
Yeah, I am. I did study quite a lot of psychology, not at university, I wish I had actually, but more recently. And I do find it fascinating how people's childhoods impact on their behaviour and how much of what we do is not very conscious, you know, that we're driven by all this sort of programming from our past, and so many decisions we make, we think they're rational, but actually they're not rational at all, but we just rationalize them afterwards. So yeah, I'm really, really intrigued by all that. And being a crime writer is a great excuse, I suppose, to explore that and to research lots of weird things, strange things that people do. I've always got some tabs open on my, I mean, I was looking into psychopaths quite a bit for book three, and I just thought that's fascinating, you know, the large numbers of psychopaths that walk amongst us, very apparent in the government at the moment, but just generally, you know, it's a really interesting subject. So it's good to have an excuse to look into these sorts of things.
So I take it you've got plenty of material for book four.
Yeah, I've got two things on the go at the moment, because I've got a fourth Meg book, which is actually set in Eme, the plague village, which I'm getting a bit worried, actually, because I write about things like I wrote about hot summer when the reservoir dried out, and then I started writing about the plague. So that's I've kind of paused that at the moment. So I'm also working on a standalone, which is obviously not including Meg, so that's an interesting experience as well, to try and get inside the head of somebody completely different from Meg, because I love Meg, you know. So I want this character to be just as compelling, but not the same. And that's fascinating as well.
Is that also set in Derbyshire?
I think it will be. I want it to be set somewhere quite bleak. I'd like some swamps, but I think I can probably use a bit of poetic license. And I think it's going to be more North Derbyshire. There's a foot and mouth epidemic thread, and I think Cumbria were much worse hit than Derbyshire. But again, I can probably just use a bit of poetic license there, because it's certainly easier to use an area that I can drive to and explore. And I love Derbyshire. North Derbyshire is spectacular. So yeah, it'll probably be set up there.
Once again, the scenery has been beautifully described and the accents brilliantly captured by Caro Clark, who narrates the audiobooks. Do you talk to her before she sits down to narrate each one?
No, I don't. When I saw you last year, I said I was definitely going to meet her for the recording of the third book. But of course, then suddenly we were all locked down. So I still haven't actually even met her. So she just goes with it. I could listen to a bit. I've listened to enough to know that she's doing a fantastic job. But there's something almost too weird about listening to the words that I wrote being read back to me, and I can't listen to it. So I've listened to little bits, but I couldn't listen to the whole book. But yeah, she does an absolutely brilliant job.
The road swooped into the valley. its sun-beaten tarmac melting into the hillside. The car smelled of petrol and hot plastic, and the steering wheel stuck to my hands. DSJ Sangera was sprawling in the passenger seat beside me, legs thrown apart, head back, and we were embroiled in a pointless argument in which I'd found myself defending his girlfriend for a reason I could no longer remember. Jay's manspreading was reaching such critical levels it was impeding my access to the gear stick. "I know you're hot," I said. "No need to turn it into performance art."
Caro Clark, narrating Cut to the Bone, written by my guest, Ros Watkins. So, Ros, when hopefully the series appears on TV, who would you like to play Meg Dalton?
It's funny, I don't have a massively clear image of her in my head, weirdly, but there is an actress called Samantha Morton, and one of my friends saw her in something and she said, "Oh, she's Meg, you need her to play Meg." And I watched something with her in and I thought, yeah, actually, she would make a brilliant Meg. And she's from Nottingham as well, so she's got the Midlands accent to start with. And yeah, she's not too glamorous. You know, a lot of actresses are so glamorous, but she can look good, but she can also look quite scruffy as well, like Meg is. So, yeah, I'd like her to play her.
Well, I'll be keeping my fingers crossed that she will be appearing on my TV screen on a Sunday evening and increasing the body count in the Derbyshire Hills.
Hope so.
And I'll look forward to welcoming you back onto the show with either book four or the standalone book.
That would be lovely. Thank you.
Cut to the Bone by Ros Watkins joins the first two books in the D.I. Meg Dalton series in the R&IB Talking Books Library. And Ros will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. The Book of Echoes is the stunning debut novel by Rosanna Amoka. The tale of how a boy from Brixton and a girl from Lagos reinvent their lives on the streets of Brixton is a powerfully redemptive story of love and hope rippling across generations.
200 years, Wind and I have roamed. 200 years we have waited by these docks. And in that time, we have seen many changes, watched many beginnings. I am their beginning, the womb whence they came. It was not out of choice that my children were separated. Not out of choice I was joined with their fathers. Uzo, my firstborn, was a round and healthy baby who giggled when I tickled him under his chin. Eze, my husband, was proud. We were happy in our small village, surrounded by the lush green bush which shaded us from the African sun. We woke to the sound of the cockerel, and each morning I rose from the mat where we lay to clang my pot on top of an open fire and fetch water from the stream as Uzo slept peacefully on my back.
Waruchi Opia narrating The Book of Echoes, written by my guest, Rosanna Amoka. Rosanna, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
It's a wonderful story of the redemptive power of love and hope. I can't believe it's your debut novel, actually.
Yeah, it is my debut novel, and it's been a long journey to get here, and I'm just amazed that I actually got here. After 20 years of trying to get here.
As you say, the book has been 20 years in the writing, and I believe you started writing it for a very specific reason.
Yes, I was away from home working in Scotland at the time, and I started writing it partly because I was homesick and partly because I also didn't have a TV. So I thought, OK, let me start putting pen to paper. What ended up happening is, you know, as I started to write the story, Michael's story came first and then Ngozi's story. But in the process of writing their stories, the spirit, the African enslaved woman's spirit, came and said, "No, actually, I want to tell this story," and took over.
She is a spirit who watches over Michael and Ngozi. And while she can't take any part in forging their destiny, she's a reminder to them. They can feel a presence.
Yes, they can.
She's a reminder of their ancestry when they sometimes feel alienated by the world around them. And certainly in the first few chapters, some pretty terrible events happen.
Yes.
And I think you present those so that we can see why the characters are as they are later in the book.
Yes, how they are later on in the book. But I think when I first started writing it 20 years ago, there was a lot of headlines in the newspapers about statistics and, you know, this and that. And it was always about terrible things happening to people of colour. And I suppose in a way that beginning was a way of answering those statistics that, yes, terrible things happen in life and you might be part of that statistic at that point, but it doesn't tell you the whole story of those people.
And it peels back the layers and allows you to see why people feel the way they do. I was very much struck by Ngozi's story, the young girl who becomes a modern day slave in Nigeria and has to escape. She never gives up hope. She is determined not to become a victim and to fight her way out.
Yeah, I think the term modern day slave makes it sound like this is something that's alien to us. Her life and the route that she takes is not alien to this country. It's the story of poverty. You know, there was lots of maids in this country that lived a life like that, like Ngozi is living. And it's about understanding the connections of Ngozi's journey to the history of this country and how people escaped that story from here. And part of that is escaping poverty and the things that were put in place. So hopefully, if we make the connections, we can find some of the answers to how she can escape from poverty.
Her story is told in parallel to a nameless slave girl from the 18th century who is snatched from her Nigerian village and shipped to Jamaica. What really struck me was that nameless slave's history is utterly erased, which gives a clue to both Michael and Ngozi's stories in modern day London, where they feel a lack of ancestry.
Yes. So it's told by, as you said, an 18th century enslaved African woman. It goes back to that triangular route, isn't it, of slavery. So from the UK to Africa, from Africa, so Caribbean or America, and back here again. And it's about how that history, unfortunately, it seems like we're not connected. But if you go back far enough, we're all connected in that history.
You delve into the troubled history of London being at the apex of the slave trade. And actually, there's a scene in the Docklands where a group of children are standing by a statue of a sugar merchant without really knowing the ramifications of what he did.
Yes. Recent events since the book has been published, it's amazing what has happened. May his soul rest in peace. But the death of George Floyd has brought this to the forefront, hasn't it? Yeah, and that statue has recently been removed. But at the time when I was writing it and it was published, that statue was there still in place with people walking past it each day.
Yes, you make the very pertinent point that the people who lost their lives as a result of the sugar trade are anonymous and forgotten, whereas Robert Milligan isn't.
Yes, Robert Milligan, his statue was still there with his name and information of being one of the owners of the docks.
And Michael, your Brixton born and raised character, experiences some of the police brutality that has been so much in the news, and it's a ghost that haunts him for years to come.
Yes. Unfortunately, I mean, as I said, this is a book that I wrote 20 years ago, and at the time I had heard of people dying in police custody, and it's just so sad that here we are in 2020 and these things are still happening. I was just telling the story that I felt was important to tell, and it seems to have finally been published at a time that more eyes are open, if you know what I mean.
The book doesn't just span different centuries, it also spans different generations. And one of those is Fred and Eliza, who are Michael's aunt and uncle and who arrived on the Windrush.
Yes. I thought it was important at the time writing it. As I said, I was homesick for that kind of home that they provide and the cooking and the openness to other people, you know, the open doors that they provided, that generation of my grandparents. So, yeah, I wanted to pay homage to them.
And they are very much the stiff upper lip generation. They don't complain. They just get on with it.
Yes, that was my grandparents.
And because you're charting the changes in the area of Brixton in the 80s and 90s, that Windrush generation is beginning to move out.
Yeah, they're beginning to move out, beginning to pass away. Yeah, that generation, unfortunately or fortunately, we have been very blessed to have their guidance and their love, but they're getting older.
And many are, as you point out in the book, either moving to the Caribbean or going to Africa or just moving out of London because they can no longer afford to live there.
Or moving to cheaper parts of London or, as I said, passing away.
Again, it's a fracturing of community.
Yes.
And that leads to a fracturing of identity.
It does. It does.
Well, I have been engrossed. I have been thoroughly enjoying the book. And part of that is because it has the most amazing narrator, Waruchi Opia.
Yes. She is wonderful.
Did you have anything to do with her selection?
They sent me some voiceovers for a list of actresses and she stood out. So I said, that's the one, but it wasn't just me. They obviously agreed as well.
She really captures an enormous cast of characters. You have native Londoners, people from Essex, people from all over Africa and the Caribbean. And she's a joy to listen to.
She is. She's fantastic. I don't know who else could have done the variety of voices that the book needed. I have family members or friends that are blind and partially sighted. So it's an added layer.
Not being able to see the text of the book, I was wondering whether you wrote the book in the voices as they sound or whether that's her interpretation of the word on the page.
When I wrote the book, I wrote it through the eyes of the narrator, but the voices that were heard. So she's reading the text from the book, but, you know, she brings her own way of putting it across as well. She's a fantastic actress. Yeah, but the text is there. She read the text.
You, as you mentioned, have blind and partially sighted friends. You must be delighted that they're going to be able to access the book as well.
Yes. Definitely. One of them just told me that they just finished it and they really enjoyed it as well.
With the book having been 20 years in the writing, are you now embarked on another book?
Yes, I am. But hopefully it won't take me 20 years this time. Well, I must say that although it took me 20 years to get it published, it didn't take me 20 years to write. So I wrote it in 6 months and then I sent it out, got a whole load of rejections and then did some rewrites. So I kept going backwards and forwards, just trying to push it forward and trying to get it published.
So Ngozi's spirit lives in you too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Rosanna, was there a book that you read as a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, there was a book called Silas Marner by George Eliot. I think I was about 12 at the time when I read that book and I absolutely fell in love with it and I thought, I wish I could write. So, yeah, Silas Marner.
Some women, I grant, would not appear to advantage seated on a pillion and attired in a drab Joseph and a drab beaver bonnet with a crown resembling a small stew pan. For a garment suggesting a coachman's greatcoat, cut out under an exiguity of cloth that would only allow of miniature capes, is not well adapted to conceal deficiencies of contours, nor is drab a colour that will throw sallow cheeks into lively contrast. It was all the greater triumph to Miss Nancy Lammeter's beauty that she looked thoroughly bewitching in that costume, as seated on the pillion, behind her tall, erect father, she held one arm around him, and looking down with open-eyed anxiety at the treacherous snow-covered pools and puddles, which sent up formidable splashings of mud under the stamp of Dobbin's foot. A painter would perhaps have preferred her in those moments when she was free from self-consciousness, but certainly the bloom on her cheeks was at the highest point of contrast when the surrounding drab, when she arrived at the door of the Red House and saw Mr. Godfrey Cass ready to lift her from the pillion. She wished her sister Priscilla had come up at the same time with the servant, for then she could have contrived that Mr. Godfrey should have lifted off Priscilla first, and in the meantime she would have persuaded her father to go round to the horse block instead of alighting at the doorsteps. It was very painful when you had made it quite clear to a young man that you were determined not to marry him, however much he might wish it, that he would still continue to pay you marked attentions. Besides, why didn't he always show the same attentions, if he meant them sincerely, instead of being so strange as Mr. Godfrey Cass was, sometimes behaving as if he didn't want to speak to her, and taking no notice of her for weeks and weeks, and then, all on a sudden, almost making love again?
Gabriel Wolfe narrating Silas Marner by George Eliot, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, Homemade Love by J. California Cooper. It's a collection of short stories and it's just full of wisdom. It's quite funny, quite sad, and because it's a short story collection, you can go and come back to it as you like.
Anne Ellen was a husky-looking, mannish-looking woman who wore pants, a straw hat, and a red-flowered blouse. I will always remember that. I was crying when she came, scared. I stared at her, our new mama, wondering what was she going to be like? What would she do with us? To us, for us? Would she want us? I was only 5 years old and already had to worry about my survival, our lives. I'm telling you, look at your mama if she be living and be thankful to God.
Homemade Love by J. California Cooper is available as a commercial audiobook, which is read by various narrators. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Believe it or not, I don't know why it took me so long to read this book, but James Baldwin's Aunt Giovanni's Room. It takes part in Paris, and it's a story about a gentleman that's come into terms with his sexuality and the effect of that on the lives around him.
I met Giovanni during my second year in Paris, when I had no money. On the morning of the evening that we met, I had been turned out of my room. I did not owe an awful lot of money, only around 6,000 francs, but Parisian hotel keepers have a way of smelling poverty, and then they do what anybody does who is aware of a bad smell, they throw whatever stinks outside. My father had money in his account which belonged to me, but he was very reluctant to send it because he wanted me to come home. To come home, as he said, and settle down. And whenever he said that, I thought of the sediment at the bottom of a stagnant pond. I did not, then, know many people in Paris, and Hella was in Spain. Most of the people I knew in Paris were, as Parisians sometimes put it, of le milieu, and while this milieu was certainly anxious enough to claim me, I was intent on proving, to them and to myself, that I was not of their company. I did this by being in their company a great deal, and manifesting towards all of them a tolerance which placed me, I believe, above suspicion. I had written to friends for money, of course, but the Atlantic Ocean is deep and wide, and money doesn't hurry from the other side. So I went through my address book, sitting over a tepid coffee in a boulevard cafe, and decided to call up an old acquaintance who was always asking me to call, an aging, Belgian-born, American businessman named Jacques. He had a big, comfortable apartment, and lots of things to drink, and lots of money. He was, as I knew he would be, surprised to hear from me. And before the surprise and charm wore off, giving him time to become wary, he had invited me for supper. He may have been cursing as he hung up and reaching for his wallet, but it was too late. Jacques is not too bad. Perhaps he is a fool and a coward, but almost everybody is one or the other, and most people are both.
Greg Lockett, narrating Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin. which is also available in Braille. Well, Rosanna Amaka, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and sharing your love of reading. The Book of Echoes by Rosanna Amaka is available in print, ebook, and audio. It can be difficult to strike a good work-life balance at the best of times, and it's something that Detective Manon Bradshaw finds particularly hard. But at the start of Susie Steiner's latest novel, Remain Silent, the irascible detective thinks she's got life sussed with her new job working cold cases. And then she finds a body and is plunged into very hot water. Susie Steiner joined me to discuss her new book and her family history of sight loss. The new book starts with Manon juggling her work-life balance and finding a body.
Yes, that's the prime novel trope, I'm afraid. Manon has got a very young child, which means she's out and about at a very ungodly hour. And she's in a bit of sort of country parkland near her home with this very small boy, her son called Teddy, when she sees a pair of boots very high up, at sort of head height, in a tree. And she runs away because she doesn't want Teddy to see it. At first, everything points to suicide, but there is a note pinned on the man's trouser leg which says the dead cannot speak, and that makes it a murder investigation. And she's assigned to it. And in lots of ways, she thinks, I can't cope with this. I've got too much going on. I've got a preschool age son. She has adopted a teenager. And for the backstory of that, you'd have to read Missing Presumed, because it's a character from one of her investigations. And this investigation leads into the world of migrant workers in Wisbeach, which is in the heart of the most productive agricultural farmland in England. Well, in Britain, I think, actually, that relies on cheap migrant labour. This is going to be the huge problem with Brexit, is we won't have any crisp apples in our local supermarkets because there's no one to pick them. And they are housed in inhumane conditions. The farms in the fens are so huge, they're so industrial sized, that they need a kind of on-demand labour force. So it's seasonal, so they need to be able to hire a huge number of people at very short notice. And this has given rise to a kind of Baltic exchange, although it's not an exchange because illegal gangmasters are running them, and that's slavery.
And as with your previous two Manon books, you've done your research very thoroughly, and you actually have a contact who helps you with a lot of the background.
Yeah, so I have a police detective who's now my friend, who I can call anytime and say, what would you do in this situation? So with this story, I rang up and I said, I'm going to do modern slavery, Lithuania. And he said, oh yeah, I've just come back from there, actually. So he knew a lot about it, but he also put me in touch with the anti-exploitation team. Yeah, he's crucial to my books. I couldn't write them without him. The police have an operation called Operation Pheasant to clamp down on modern slavery. And they have successfully prosecuted one set of gangmasters. So it's not that they're losing the fight. They're doing very well.
It leads Manon into a world of crime. Just when she thinks that she's managed to get off the front line and is working a three-day week solving cold cases.
Yes, the shift patterns are a big problem for women because people are not murdered at convenient times of the day in the week. And so you have to be able to go out on a job at midnight if needs be. And for women with young children, that's very difficult to be on call like that. So she opts to go on to cold cases where there isn't that 24-hour response needed. But she misses the cut and thrust of a live job. I think a lot of women go through this when they go back to work. They go for a part-time pattern, but the work's more boring.
And
just to complicate matters, her relationship with her partner is not at its freshest.
Yes, they're not in the first flush.
And he has his own problems in this novel as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he has a terrible time.
You like putting Manon and her immediate family through the mill.
Well, I think in novels you have to. You take the character you love and you put them under extreme pressure, because that's when you find out who someone is, when they're under immense pressure.
Is there a freedom in being able to write a character who's that irascible and outspoken?
Yes. I mean, I feel she's normal. She's short-tempered and she feels things. She's not at all cut off. In fact, she's the opposite of cut off. She erupts and then feels terrible. I would not want to write someone who was cut off from their feelings and who was cold and kind of said the right things all the time. She's hot-blooded, and that's what I like about her.
And she's also determined to find the truth. She won't let anything stand in the way of uncovering even rather unpleasant and disturbing truths.
Yeah, she's good at her job. She's not silly.
Now, we're hopefully coming to the end of lockdown. And one thing that really struck me about Remain Silent is that it's as much an examination of the intensity of domestic life as it is a murder story. It's very much about how human beings interact with each other under strain.
Yeah, that's right. Lockdown presents a huge problem for novelists because, A, it's what we're living, and what we're living tends to creep into your books. But on the other hand, I don't think anyone's going to want to read about lockdown. I certainly don't. It was bad enough living it. I don't want to read a novel about it. It's like heatwave novels. They're coming now. There was that horrendous heatwave a couple of years ago. Now the heatwave novels are all emerging. But the main problem with lockdown is that it's actually not a creative time. Although there's time, there isn't inspiration. To have inspiration, you need to be living and you need to be out there. And things need to be happening to you. And so actually lockdown is a curiously uncreative situation, because for output, there has to be input.
So do I take it that you haven't made much progress on the next case for Manon?
I've hardly made any progress and I feel constantly guilty. Writing novels is a bit like permanently revising for your A-levels. You're always doing another revision timetable in place of actually revising. So I don't think lockdown is an interesting thing to write about, because it's an absence of things happening and novels need to be full of event.
One thing that has certainly kept me going through lockdown is listening to audiobooks. And again, you have the wonderful Juanita McMahon narrating Remain Silent. She really does suit the part of Manon very well, doesn't she?
I haven't listened to it, I have to confess. There's something very weird about hearing your own work read out by somebody else. So I haven't gone down that road. I should, I really should, because I haven't heard her read it at all.
Initially, no one answers the door. They ring and knock again. Davy shouts, "Police!" through the letterbox. Eventually, a sleepy man in tracksuit bottoms and a T-shirt opens the door, leaves it open and walks away from them, back up the stairs without speaking. They stand awkwardly in the hallway until a rotund, bald man greets them from the back of the house, holding out his hand.
"Hello, I'm Eddie Gass. How can I help you?"
he says, in Russian. Eddie Gass arranges for Davy to talk to various residents. It is an awkward business, as there is no seating. What would have been a lounge is set with mattresses, and the kitchen is a galley without a table. The house is dirty. Smells of microwave dinners, the kind made from meat of unknown provenance. Davy stands at the doorway to one of the bedrooms with his notepad.
His interviewee sits on a mattress, knees up, back to the wall. He doesn't make eye contact. Everyone denies knowing Lucas or anything about Lucas.
Juanita McMahon narrating Remain Silent, written by my guest, Susie Steiner. You're not the only member of the Steiner family who has been broadcast on RNIB Connect Radio recently. We've been playing out your mother's wonderful guide dog diaries. It's clear that writing runs in the family.
Actually, that was her first foray. Her blindness has now got to a point where it's really stopping her doing much. So she struggles with boredom. And so I think it came out of, it was something she could do.
And there are certainly wonderful observational pieces about the strange things that people say to you when you are blind. I don't know whether you find that yourself.
Actually, I have been a bit in denial about my blindness up to lockdown. So, for example, I didn't like using my stick, whereas now I have to because otherwise I walk into people and get into fights. So I never go out without my white stick now. And people do come up to me and say, how do you do X or Y? Because people still have the misapprehension that you either can see or it's black. So I have spent a lot of time explaining that there are gradations, you know, there is blurriness and there is fogginess. It's not necessarily that the lights are just off. Yeah, it's interesting. I partly get it more because I go out with a white stick, but because I've got a bit of macular vision, I can take out my phone and read it. And that really confuses people.
Yes, my own retinitis pigmentosa has got to a stage where I can't actually see anything on the phone anymore. But I do remember feeling almost like a fraud when I pulled my phone out. Yes. This isn't what people are expecting.
And the same with, I have a Kindle where the words are so enormous that there's hardly any per page. But that does get me funny looks when I get on the tube with a white stick and then start reading.
Yes, we certainly need to extend the understanding of the nuances of sight loss, I think.
RNIB did a brilliant series of films called What I See or something like that. And it was a film where the outer edges were blurred in the case of retinitis pigmentosa, or there was just a kind of clouded film over it. And it really did express what you see. It was brilliant.
So you're still reading your books predominantly in Kindle, are you? Or are you listening to more audiobooks now?
No, I can still read. I've got immensely strong reading glasses and everything is magnified to the nth degree. But there is something different about the internal voice of reading. At the beginning of lockdown, I listened to Middlemarch on audiobook, read by Juliet Stevenson, and I enjoyed that. But that's partly because I know Middlemarch very well. So if I fell asleep and came round, I knew where I was.
Well, I am thoroughly looking forward to finishing Remain Silent and to finding out who done it and whether Manon can get her work-life balance sorted out again. But in the meantime, Susie Steiner, thank you so much for coming back onto the show and talking about the latest novel.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to talk to you, Red.
All three of Susie Steiner's Manon Bradshaw novels are available from the RNIB library. And listen out for her mum Deborah's Guide Dog Diaries on the Daily Connect.
Now it's back to Roz Watkins for the books of her life. So Roz, was there a book that you read when you were a younger person that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
There were lots, but the one I'm going to choose is Charlotte's Web, particularly because the book we've just been talking about features pigs. And that book made me love pigs, it made me love spiders, and it made me love rats. And I did actually have pet rats when I was a kid. And I've always been a great protector and defender of spiders and do my best with pigs as well. So I think that book obviously influenced me quite a lot. A brilliant book.
A spider's web is stronger than it looks. Although it is made of thin, delicate strands, the web is not easily broken. However, a web gets torn every day by the insects that kick around in it, and a spider must rebuild it when it gets full of holes. Charlotte liked to do her weaving during the late afternoon, and Fern liked to sit nearby and watch. One afternoon, she heard a most interesting conversation and witnessed a strange event.
"You have awfully hairy legs, Charlotte," said Wilbur, as the spider busily worked at her task.
"My legs are hairy for a good reason," replied Charlotte. "Furthermore, each leg of mine has 7 sections, the coxa, the trochanter, the femur, the patella, the tibia, the metatarsus, and the tarsus."
Wilbur sat bolt upright. "You're kidding," he said.
"No, I'm not either."
Liza Ross narrating Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
It's a slightly strange one to curl up with, but I absolutely love the book The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks. It's one of those books you can just dip into and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, who could not be? It's basically about his cases as a neurologist, so intriguing and unusual cases. So you've got things like a pair of twins who only communicate with each other by reeling off prime numbers at each other, and a man who actually did mistake his wife for a hat and stuff like that. Fascinating.
Mrs. O.C. was somewhat deaf, but otherwise in good health. She lived in an old people's home. One night in January 1979, she dreamt vividly, nostalgically, of her childhood in Ireland, and especially of the songs they danced to and sang. When she woke up, the music was still going, very loud and clear. "I must still be dreaming," she thought, but this was not so. She got up, roused and puzzled. It was the middle of the night. Someone, she assumed, must have left a radio playing, but why was she the only person to be disturbed by it? She checked every radio she could find. They were all turned off. Then she had another idea. She'd heard that dental fillings could sometimes act like a crystal radio, picking up stray broadcasts with unusual intensity. "That's it," she thought. "One of my fillings is playing up. It won't last long. I'll get it fixed in the morning." She complained to the night nurse, who said that her fillings looked fine. At this point, another notion occurred to Mrs. O.C. What sort of radio station, she reasoned to herself, would play Irish songs deafeningly in the middle of the night? Songs, just songs, without introduction or comment, and only songs that I know. What radio station would play my songs and nothing else? At this point, she asked herself, is the radio in my head?
William Abney, narrating the talking book version of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks. Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
Hopefully this is in the library. It's a book called Ghost Boy by Martin Pistorius. And for my standalone, I've been researching people with a thing called locked-in syndrome, where you're still fully conscious, but you can't move, or some of them can blink one or two eyelids, like the Diving Bell and the Butterfly guy. But this Martin Pistorius, he actually was locked in for many, many years, conscious and unable to move anything at all. So nobody even knew he was in there. And it's something I've been researching for the book. And it's obviously horrific and fascinating. But his story actually has a happy ending, which is amazing. They discovered that he was conscious and he gradually improved. And now he can communicate and he's got married and he's successful and he does TED Talks. And it's a sort of terrifying but also inspiring story.
I'm a sea creature, crawling along the ocean floor. It's dark here, cold. There's nothing but blackness above, below, and all around me. But then I begin to see snatches of light glimmering overhead. I don't understand what they are. Something tells me I must try to reach them. It drives me upwards as I kick towards the shards of light, which skitter across the surface far above me. They dance as they weave patterns of gold and shadow. My eyes focus. I'm staring at a baseboard. I'm sure it looks different than it normally does, but I don't know how I know this. A whisper across my face. Wind. I can smell sunshine. Music, high and tinny. Children singing. Their voices fade in and out, loud, then muffled, until they fall silent. A carpet swims into view. It's a swirl of black, white, and brown. I stare at it, trying to make my eyes focus, but the darkness comes for me again. A washcloth is pushed cold across my face, and I feel my cheek flame in disapproval as a hand holds my neck steady. "I won't take a second," a voice says. "We've got to make sure you're a clean boy now, don't we?"
Ghost Boy, written by Martin Pistorius and narrated by Simon Bubb, is available commercially. Ros Watkins, thank you so much for coming back onto the show and sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners. And I'll look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Oh, thank you. It's really lovely to talk to you.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.